Welcome back to another episode of the Brew Deck Podcast. I am your host today, Heather, and I am joined by Cheyenne, of course. Hi, Cheyenne.
Hello.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm doing good. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm excited about today's topic.
I am too. I'm actually, I've learned a lot from all the awesome interviews that we did. So I'm very excited about today's episode.
Me too. Toby and Adam will be joining us a little bit later while we do our interviews, but it's just the ladies for now. Before we dive into, I love that we teased it, but aren't going to tell anybody what the topic is.
I think if they can see the topic in the episode title, so they know what we're talking about.
Quite true. We're just going to hold off for a little bit longer. We are 13 days away from CBC.
That is crazy.
I know I've been saying this since we were like 140 days away. But I honestly cannot believe that it is that close. So make sure you come by our booth. We are at booth 961. You can't miss us. We've got a whole bunch of things going on. Live podcast recordings for one of them. So please come by and say hi. We've also collaborated with a lot of local Nevada breweries for a whole bunch of brews, and not just brews. We've also got hop water, hard seltzer, and cider, and they'll all be served at our booth. So make sure you come by and see that.
Also at our booth, which I think is even more exciting, we're going to have puppies at our booth this year. We're really excited to sponsor the first ever Pause and Relax Lounge in the Brew Expo America. It's bringing therapy dogs to trade show attendees. They will be visiting our booth throughout the trade show. So come pet some puppies, say hi to us on the podcast. It's going to be a whole party over at our booth.
I might not even record anything. I might just be hanging out with the puppies the entire time.
Heather's just in the corner with the puppy.
If anybody needs me, I'll be with the puppy.
We also have pinball again. So that's going to be really fun. We need to do a podcast team pinball tournament, I think.
Oh, you're on. I think I'm actually terrible at pinball. I, for some reason, feel like Toby's probably like really good at pinball.
Oh, yeah. He definitely gives off those vibes.
He definitely does. And I think one of the most exciting things that is going on this year at CBC, we are a sponsor of the National Black Brewers Association. CBC Tap Takeover at Beer Zombies Brewery. It's on Tuesday, the 23rd, from 6 till 10. The Tap Takeover is going to feature 20 beers from Black-owned and operated breweries that are members of the National Black Brewers Association. So check that out. I think all the information is up on their website as well. So make sure to check that out. And we are really excited that we get to go.
Definitely.
All right. So I guess we can start with the episode. Before we dive into this, we do want to say that our lovely editor, Haley, gave us some really good puns to introduce this episode. So we're just going to tell you all the puns that Haley came up with. So this episode, we're talking about rye malt and all the cool things that you can do with rye malt. So Haley's puns are rise and shine.
Rye not.
And ridiculously good. So thank you for those, Haley. The puns only really come out of Adam's mouth, so they don't sound as good when Cheyenne and I say them, but we really wanted to make sure everybody got to hear the amazing puns. We do have some really cool guests today. We've got Spike Bukowski from Terrapin Brewing. He is the founder and VP of Brewing Development to talk about the very first beer that they launched, which was a rye pale ale. We also have our resident distilling guru, Jeff Fisher, territory manager at Country Malt Group, and making his podcast debut, Mac Remington, who is a production supervisor over at Canada Malting, talking about malting rye. So let's dive in.
I am glad to have this dude back on. I haven't talked to him in a long time. And he's been around the block a little bit, and I miss him. Miss hanging out with him. Mr. Spike Bukowski, the founder and VP of Brewing Development at Terrapin Beer. How's it going, Spike?
That's me. Thank you so much for having me. I am doing very well.
Have you had to tar any parking lots recently?
No. I think my those days are pretty much over. So.
Okay, there's a story there. I think we're going to
hear. I thought I was the only one that knew about that.
There is a story about how John and I, and this is how Terrapin really came to life. And it kind of goes full circle, and I'm sure we'll talk about our brewery that is in the Truist Park at the Braves Stadium in Atlanta. But how the idea behind Terrapin and the start of Terrapin actually happened after going to a Braves opening day game back around 1999, 98, somewhere in there. We had left for the day our brewing positions, myself, my soon-to-be business partner, and our boss went to the Braves opening day game. And then the next day we came back to work and got scolded by the owner of the company. And it was our duty. Basically, he handed us three rollers and three buckets of tar. And for our punishment, we had to roll the brewery parking lot and re-tar it with the rollers. So while we were doing that, there were obviously a lot of cussing and a lot of back and forth. And we're like, well, screw this guy. We'll start our own brewery. So it just kind of started as a joke that we were going to start this brewery. But the more we thought about it and the more we put our heads together, we came up with the idea to do so. There was a lot of bad names thrown around in the beginning. And then I kind of went back to my Grateful Dead roots and, you know, have followed the Dead during college and after, and loved the Terrapin Station album. So we decided to run with Terrapin for the name of the brewery.
Did the Braves win that game?
I don't remember that, but in the end, I think we won. So,
yeah, it's worked. It's worked out all right over the years, right?
It worked out. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're talking. What are we talking about today? Rye, right?
Rye.
Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
Something rye.
Sort of touched. It's been a while. Anyways, Spike, it's good to have you on. Absolutely good chatting with you again. And I was again thoroughly surprised when I learned you're jumping on with. So yeah, you told us a little bit about the history of Terrapin.
Yep.
What are y'all working on? 22 years, something like that.
Yeah. So April 20th will be our 22nd anniversary. So we've definitely have come a long way. With brewing, and you know, we are talking about rye, and you know, this goes back to the 90s. So just to give you a little background about my experience, when I graduated college, I went to Southern Connecticut State University up in New Haven, Connecticut, and when I graduated, I moved to Florida, and my roommate actually moved to the West Coast. So he was in Berkeley, California. So after I found Florida too hot and flat, I had a fraternity brother who lived in Atlanta. So in 92, I moved to Atlanta, but I was still in contact with my college roommate out in Berkeley at the time. And he was like, Spike, have you ever tried homebrewing? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. He goes, you can make beer at home. I'm like, okay. So when I moved to Atlanta, we actually had a basement, which was, you know, a great place to ferment the beer and age the beer and all that, because it was, you know, obviously a cooler temperature in the basement. So I started homebrewing back in probably about 93. And I started incorporating rye, and it was pretty funny because the homebrew shops thought I was nuts brewing with rye, you know, especially back in the early 90s. And the reason for it was I knew that in the Southeast, don't forget, this was early 90s. You know, there was a lot of Bud, Miller, Coors drinkers down there that didn't really understand, you know, the aggressiveness of hops and just, you know, a good pale ale. Right. So I was drinking Sierra Nevada at the time and wanted to do a beer, didn't know I was going to bring it obviously to the masses. But when I started playing around with rye, I kind of noticed how it made the beer a little bit more crisp, had a little spicy note. But the cool thing was it really dried your palate out. So when I put the rye pale ale recipe together, I kind of used like low Cohemulone hops, right? So it was you know, German Magnums at 60. And then we used a little bit of Fuggle at 30, and then EKG for the little flavoring addition, Cascade in the Whirlpool, and then dry hop with Amarillo. And what I came up with was a beer that had a beautiful aroma and upfront bitterness. But at the end, the rye kind of just cleaned your palate up and made it this nice, short bitterness and very clean palate, where it was tolerant of people that didn't understand, you know, at this point in time was a 35 BU beer, but back in the early 90s was pretty aggressive. So I wanted to make something with a lot of flavor and aroma, but a very clean finish that people can actually drink and enjoy multiple beers or multiple pints, if you will.
Sounds tasty. But it is 10 after 10 my time, but it sounds wonderful. Sounds great. So I'm going to miss this, Spike, but why did y'all decide, hey, this is the beer that we want to launch with? Or I guess, let me back up. Is this the beer that, hey, this is the first one that y'all poured out of the tap?
Yeah. This was it. I mean, we were going big or going home. You know, when we launched the product in 2002, there really weren't IPAs, right? Everything is IPA, IPA, IPA. So again, you know, taking a page out of the Sierra Nevada playbook, I mean, it was pale ale, right? That was the aggressive style. But for me, like I said, it was just hard to make that work in the Southeast, right? So when we launched, it was our, you know, kind of our mantra to one of our taglines was extreme beers for extreme tastes, right? So we really were pushing the envelope, but now that beer is just a little baby pale ale. I mean, with all the big, huge IPAs that are around today, you know, this one is just a baby little pale ale that that anybody can drink, you know?
Yeah. Do you remember, I guess, year one, mm-hmm. Terrapin, do you remember how many barrels y'all produced? Just curious.
Yeah, it was, I think, 230 barrels. So basically, yeah, 230.
Jeez. And what are y'all doing now? Sorry to cut you off there, but.
Yeah, no problem. Close to 90. So we should be high 80s in 2024.
Just small growth. Just small growth.
Yeah. Well, don't forget that that's 22 years, right? So the funny thing, you know, back then it was taboo being a contract brewer, right? So, you know, now it's called gypsy brewing, right? You run around the world and you brew at other people's facilities and, you know, you have a family feud with your brother and all of a sudden you're a popular gypsy brewer. But back then, we were just contract brewing. John and I didn't have the money, right? I mean, we started this brewery on our credit cards. So there was a brewery probably about 5 miles from my house in Atlanta. So I went down there, started brewing rye pale ale draft only in 2002, sorry. And we started distribution in Athens, Georgia, draft only. And it was kind of funny because, you know, we didn't have a brewery, so we got a lot of crazy looks to how we were getting our beer to market. But the great part was, is 6 months after we launched the rye pale ale, it actually won best pale ale in the country at the Great American Beer Festival.
Wow.
So right out of the gate, you know, people really love the product. And in so much so that, you know, we were pushing that brewery to its capacity. So probably about a year or so later, or 2 years later, we had to find another facility. And this is a great story in itself. Like, we looked up and down the East Coast and we found a brewer in Maryland, and it was Frederick Brewing Company, which changed to Flying Dog all those years ago. But we started brewing up there. And if you can imagine John and I walking around Athens, and you know, obviously there's a university up there called, you know, the University of Maryland, and their mascot is Terrapin, right? So we would walk downtown Athens and walk into places and go, "Hey guys, ever heard of Terrapin Beer Company?" No, we're, you know, what are you guys all about? They said, "Well, we've got this product that's rye pale ale, and you know, we'd love to get it on tap here." And I go, "Oh, Terrapin, you guys from Maryland? No, we're not from Maryland. We're going to build a brewery right here in Athens, Georgia. And you're like, oh, really? Athens? Well, where is it? And I'm like, well, we really don't have a brewery right now. And people would look at us and go, well, where is it being made? And we would go, Maryland. So, you know, it was kind of hard to peddle your product when people already had this, conceived notion that we were from Maryland and we really weren't, but we were called Terrapin, but we really didn't have a brewery. And it was hard. It was hard to get the product into people's hands because, you know, it was a contract brewery. And back in the 90s, you know, the early 2000s, that really wasn't a popular thing back then, you know, like it is now.
Yeah. And it sounds like from what you're saying is that first year, y'all just with winning a JBF and then mm-hmm. out just working your ass off trying to get the, it's like you were just holding on by the seat of your pants. Were you just sitting back like, holy shit, this is really happening?
Yeah. And it was the hard part too, because at the time, that brewery up in Maryland was going through some financial times and troubles. And basically for us to be able to brew, John and I would have to purchase the silo malt. So we would charge on our credit cards to get a batch of silo malt to brew our beer. And it was crazy, as you can imagine. I mean, you know, we almost walked away from it multiple times, but, you know, we stuck it out and, you know, here we are 22 years later having this conversation.
Oh yeah. Well, it's, so how long were y'all producing that core, the rye pale ale? And at what point did you decide, hey, you know, let's take it out of commission for a while?
Yeah, we were probably brewing that close to 12 years or so. So basically what happened was when the IPA craze happened, pale ales went away. Right. So we changed our focus to IPAs. I mean, we were one of the first breweries in the country, if not the first brewery, to offer an IPA variety pack.
What's
now they're everywhere.
What's an IPA?
Yeah.
Never.
India Pale Ale.
Oh, really?
Well, it depends. These days, I don't know. The lines are a little blurred. If you want to have another talk sometime about what people call IPAs now, that's probably another discussion. But, you know, back when I was around, I mean, you know, Arrogant Bastard and just all these huge beers were coming out of California. And, you know, IPAs, it was no less than 70 BUs in an IPA. Now IPAs are like 32 BUs. Really? So yeah, that, you know, that those kind of beers took over the landscape and the pale ale kind of went away. And we basically turned our focus on IPAs, you know, but like you said, the rye pale ale is slowly but surely coming back in draft form. And hopefully someday we can package it again. But, you know, right now we're still brewing some out of our second brewery.
So you did repackage it a couple years ago though, didn't you?
We did. I believe it was from the March Madness. So we do a competition every year. It's going on right now where we put in our own bracket of beers that aren't made at Terrapin anymore. And they basically all go in, you know, just like the college bracket. Right. And they all go to the end and then, yes, we brewed a batch and put it out there. So not sure who's going to win this year, but we will find out.
Were you surprised when that won? Like,
no, absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not. I mean, it is my sentimental favorite, and it's a lot of people's sentimental favorite. So it was no surprise to me that it won.
What is it about a rye ale that stands out for you? What is it that that you like about it?
Well, I can't speak for everybody's rye, which there aren't a lot anymore. I'm not sure if what was the one? Was it Red Racer, Racer X or something from Bear Republic? They did an early on rye. I just don't remember the name of theirs. But, you know, for ours, you know, like I mentioned before, all the flavor and aromas up front. Right. I also had a little bit of honey malt in there for some sweetness. So the first thing you do is smell this beautiful aroma of Amarillo, Take your first sip. It's got that nice sweetness to it from the honey malt. I use some Munich in there and some biscuit just for some nutty notes. And it's got a pretty full palate. It ends at about three Plato. But then after you swallow, it doesn't leave that big lingering bitterness. It cleans up very quickly and you're just ready for another sip. So I think with all those flavor combinations like that, it just makes for an very easy drinking beer, but it has flavor, right? And that's the thing. I think you know, as a brewer, you want people to drink more than one pint of your beers, right? If you go in and you know, oh, I've got this IPA that's 110 BUs. Okay, that's great. Can I get a 4-ounce pour? And then you're done. Where us as brewers want you to drink multiple pints of our beer. So you got to make it drinkable.
And you said you had this on tap right now at where?
Yeah, we've got some. So we've got two facilities. One is in Atlanta at Truist Park, where the Braves play. And then, of course, you know, the mothership in Athens, Georgia. So they'll be on tap there. But now we're doing a handful of accounts in Athens, Georgia. So if that gets traction, then we may, you know, put it out in Atlanta as well. But we just kind of focus. We just focus in Athens on draft at select accounts who want it.
That's awesome. So just working with rye malt in general, right? I think there's a lot of breweries that have played around with it a bit. And then obviously mm-hmm. see quite a bit more of it on the distilling side. So
yeah.
What kind of challenges do you typically have to work with when you're brewing with rye malt?
Yeah, I mean, rye, I call it the quicksand of malt is what I call it. But, you know, in our rye pale ale, there's only 10%. So we don't have to use any rice hulls. I would say anything over 10%, you better start adding some rice hulls, you know, for your lautering efficiency. But it was funny because I do, you know, collaborations all around the world, and I have stuck many a mashes where people just didn't believe me, because that's one of my things. If I do a collaboration, I always sprinkle a little rye into the malt bill. But I remember brewing with Left Hand. Gosh, this was probably 10 years ago or so, and they didn't use any rice hulls, and it was probably like a 3-hour runoff. But the crazy part is that it held on to so much wort or last runnings in the mash that when we opened to grain out, it just spilled all over the brew house floor, and it was like an hour to clean this stuff up. It was just like quicksand. It was pretty funny. So yeah, it can get really nasty. But like I said, 10% usually isn't that hard. But I would say once you get up to like 15 or so, I would start to introduce some rice hulls for lauterability.
Is there a lot of trial and error to get to that 10% sweet spot?
Yeah. I mean, you know, brewing at home, it probably took me a half a dozen times or so, because I didn't want it to overpower either. So I like everything nuanced, even when I make, you know, crazy beers like our Wake and Bake, you know, French Toast Stout, when we're adding just crazy flavors. I just want all the flavors to come in and combine and not overpower each other, right? So everything to me is about balance. And I think even if you make a very aggressive beer, as long as it's balanced, people are able to drink it, right? So if you get something super hoppy but can back it up with some complex malt character, it's a lot easier on the palate than just a one-dimensional hop bomb. So yeah, playing around, I probably started with about 20% and just kept backing it off until it kind of just complemented the sweetness from the honey malt, and then just kind of, like I said, try to just tune it in where everything was really nice and balanced.
Have you messed around with any of the crystal malts, or are you just kind of, you know, when you do brew with it, just brewing with your old school regular rye malt?
I don't think I've used any of the crystal ryes. I'd have okay. to go back and look at some recipes, but usually it's malted rye. I'm actually doing, I'm playing around with a rice lager at the stadium, where I'm adding just a touch of flake rye as well. So So I have played with the flaked rye, but 9 times out of 10, it's just the straight up malted rye.
Good stuff.
All right. So you said anniversary is coming up in.
Mm-hmm.
Any big plans?
We do have big plans. So there'll be a lot of music happening. I believe it starts at 11. It goes 11 to 8 on April 20th. We're working with our partner, Rhizome Productions. So these guys are coming in and setting up shop, and they have booked all the bands, and, you know, they are going to basically wrangle the entertainment, right? I don't want to start booking bands and things like that. So we like to collaborate with people who know that side of the business, so we can concentrate on beer and beer sales while they can concentrate on setting up the event and hiring the bands and stuff. So we're super excited about that.
Sounds awesome. Well, cool. Spike, appreciate you jumping on with us and talking a little bit about the Rye Pale.
Yeah, and, sure thing.
Yeah, continued success. I'm glad to see y'all are still kicking and doing well out there. And hopefully we can run into each other soon.
Absolutely. Well, anytime you are in the Atlanta or Athens area, let me know. Because like I said, our mothership is in Athens, Georgia. And then we've got our pilot brewery down at the Brave Stadium at Truist Park in Atlanta.
Yeah, and for the listeners out there who haven't made the trek out there and gotten a chance to visit Terrapin and have some of their wonderful beers, please do. So it's good stuff out there. And Spike, I really appreciate you jumping on again and talking to us a little bit about rye. And yeah, look forward to seeing you on our next adventure somewhere.
All right, cheers, guys. Appreciate it.
We are back, and we are very lucky to be joined by our resident distilling guru, Jeff Fisher. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks for having me back.
So we're going to jump right into it. We want to talk about what rye is like in the distilling side of things, so that we've actually discussed it in the brewing side of things. So what does rye look like in the distilling world?
So in most of distilling, especially in the United States, rye is going to be an unmalted grain. So it's mostly unmalted, just like everything else in most large scale distilling. A lot of the brands you'll see on the shelf, most of the grains in there are going to be unmalted. So malted rye is used even by some large distilleries for special runs or to add additional flavors to what they're doing. But compared to a brewery who would never really use very much unmalted rye, it's very prominent in distilling.
So can you kind of let us know where rye whiskey, I guess we're just going to pretty much talk about rye whiskey, is the most popular?
Well, yeah, the history really is it's the oldest real whiskey that was made in the United States. You can trace its roots back to about 1750, which was several decades or more before the invention, so to speak, of bourbon. This was really because rye grew very well in the mid-Atlantic states, right? So think George Washington's plantations and even up into Pennsylvania, rye grew really, really well. And whiskey was a function of kind of a way of preserving grain in a different way. So, you know, it really became popular then. And then it really grew in popularity during the Revolution. Prior to the Revolution, rum would have been the most popular spirit by far in the U.S. in the American colonies. Of course, with the Revolution and naval blockades, you couldn't bring rum in. So we had to really get back to like our Scots-Irish roots in those areas and begin whiskey distilling, grain distilling. So that's kind of the history of when it began. It was quite popular even through the early 1800s. In fact, about 3 times the amount of rye whiskey was made in the 1810s, 1820s compared to bourbon. But it slowly began to diminish over time. Up until it was, you know, it was honestly roughly about 200 years later that rye really has come back into prominence. Rye whiskey itself, not the rye used in bourbons, but a traditional rye whiskey has really become popular, let's say, in the last 20 years.
So I kind of read somewhere that it didn't really come out of Prohibition as well as some other spirits did. Like it didn't have a resurgence right after Prohibition.
It did not. So part of the problem is rye is difficult to deal with. Rye is a much harder grain to deal with than corn or wheat. And of course, malted barley. So, you know, during, especially during Prohibition, you know, moonshiners, illegal stills, rye was harder to deal with. So they wanted stuff that was easy to deal with, that was still somewhat palatable. And so rye fell out of favor. And again, it didn't really come back until after the 2000s, really, truly. There was people that always liked it. And there were distilleries that always made it, but it was a smaller portion compared to bourbons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely seeing more of a resurgence of the rye whiskey right now. We were talking a little bit about rye used in beer. Can you talk to us about why rye is more popular in a whiskey format than it is in beer?
So for a distiller, it's actually easier to deal with than a brewer. You know, I'm sure you touched base on this, but in a beer, you have to separate the grain from the liquid. So right. You have to have a liquid that's flowable at a decent rate. And doesn't leave a beer that's kind of thick. Rye does all of those things in any type of mash. It absorbs more water than any other grain, and it has usually the highest level of beta-glucans, which is like a soluble fiber. Think Metamucil in water, right? It gets thicker the longer you sit with it. So the same thing happens with rye. So in breweries, you typically don't see, you know, higher than 20-25%. We have seen beers obviously that push those limits, and if you use some enzymes it gets easier, but rye is difficult for brewers because of that separation of liquid from solid. In distilling, in most large-scale American distilling, even in a lot of craft distillers, they ferment. So they mash with the grain, obviously, then they ferment with the grain, and they distill with the grain. So even if it gets a little thicker, it gets a little gooey, or they can just water that down a bit and still pump it in a still and keep the agitation going and still come out with a 95% rye whiskey, which is fairly common. So it really has to do with how they process the fermented mash or the converted mash, so to speak.
So you said brewers are usually using tops 20-25% of rye. What is the percentage of rye used to classify it as an American rye whiskey?
So in the United States, there's really two major components that make up the definition of what is a rye whiskey. The first is the percentage of rye. It must contain at least 51% rye, and it can't go in the barrel lower than 40% alcohol, so 80 proof. Bourbon has a slightly different set of rules, but those are the two main ones when you talk about classification of, do you want to put rye whiskey on your label?
And what are the kind of the characteristics of it? What would you be looking for a rye whiskey, an American rye whiskey, to taste like?
So that's great. Rye is typically known as being spicy. And you can pick up a lot of it's not hot spicy. It is, think Christmas spicy to a point. Think lots of heavy use of the spice cabinet without inducing heat, you know, when Americans consider something spicy. So it has a lot of strong flavors to it compared to, let's say, the other great American whiskey of bourbon that's popular, where bourbon is much sweeter because of the higher use of corn. It has a smoother taste on the palate, a slightly sweeter taste. Rye, some people can describe it as a little harsh, and that's not a bad descriptor of it, meant in a good way. It's really very robust in flavor, and the higher the rye used, the more robust that rye flavor is. And again, it's typically classified as spicy. There's some floral notes and stuff to it too, but.
So before we hit record, we were chatting a little bit about rye. You were saying that you prefer to have rye in your cocktails.
So traditionally, that's what rye was really for, right? Rye was, again, and I hate using the term harsh because I don't want to really give it a negative connotation. It was more robust in flavor. And so it was typically not drank straight. That was left to bourbon. Bourbon's softer, sweeter. Contains usually less rye or potentially no rye in it. So that is really great. Neat, or with a little ice cube. Rye traditionally was added to cocktails. So if you're going to make a sweet cocktail, sometimes adding bourbon to that cocktail can make it seem too sweet. Or the flavor of the bourbon can kind of get washed out. Where if you put in a very robust tasting rye whiskey, then you allow all those beautiful spicy notes and some of the other characteristics to really bloom. And as a counterpoint to some of those sweet additives, even, you know, simple syrups or different flavored syrups or whatever that you would put in a cocktail. And even if you think traditional cocktails like Manhattans or even old fashions often were made with rye in the beginning because it allowed that, you really got a good taste of the whiskey and it allowed the whiskey to come through more than just the sweet additives.
Yeah. Well, it is 8 a.m. where we're recording right now, and now I want an old fashioned. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So switching gears a little bit back to the production side of things, what is the difference in using rye in distilling versus other types of grains?
So the same problems that you see in a brew house, rye can be difficult to deal with. Unmalted, it is very hard. Like, you really need a hammer mill. Pretty much you can do some other kind of milling with it, but it's traditionally run through some type of hammer mill. It's a really hard grain because it absorbs so much liquid compared to wheat or barley or corn. It has so much soluble fiber, it does thicken the mash some. And so oftentimes you have to dilute it a bit more to make it more flowable. Especially if you're talking high rye whiskeys, right? 95, 96% rye. Or again, you can use some extraneous enzymes. The large commercial distillers typically don't. And there's nothing wrong with adding an extraneous enzyme. That's perfectly fine. It's why they're made. You know, so you have to kind of handle it a bit differently. You know, wheat also relatively high in beta glucans, but typically doesn't have the water absorption rate that rye does. And then barley or barley malt, or even the most typical type of barley you would find in an American style whiskey, you know, does absorb some, but it also has some husk material and a few other things. And so it can help keep it seem a more fluid mash in which to deal with. Those are the main problems that a distiller would face, is just the thickness of it all and the processing of the grain itself. In getting it prepared, but they hammer mill most things anyway in March distilleries. So that's usually overcome.
And so you had mentioned the use of enzymes. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how that helps?
Sure. To process rye, the most predominant enzyme you would use would be like a beta glucanase. So beta glucans are a soluble fiber. Like I said, it's like what you think of in like a Metamucil. You mix with water and, you know, it's liquidy for a minute and you give it a second and it starts to kind of sludge up. Well, that comes from beta glucans in the psyllium husk and other things. Well, you have that again in rye and it is in your mash. So if you add a beta glucanase enzyme, it breaks down those soluble fibers and thins out the mash quite a bit. So it makes it more easily pumped. You can usually keep, without having to dilute it with water to make it thinner, you can just make a thinner mash altogether with that. That's what the enzyme would be primarily used in rye.
Awesome. Any tips and tricks you would recommend to distillers when wanting to work with rye?
Oh, sure. Again, if I personally owned a distillery, I don't have a moral problem with using extraneous enzymes. So I think they're a tool and I don't think they affect the flavor of the whiskey at all. So if you're a small distiller, you're probably using some type of enzyme anyway, either a high temp amylase or an AG enzyme. So using a beta glucanase enzyme is perfectly fine. That's one thing that I would do if I was looking to produce high rye whiskeys, even if I'm doing it on solid, but especially if I'm, you know, trying to separate solid from liquid. The other advice I would use is I would personally use some rye malt. I think it's rye malt brings some, because it is run through a kiln, so it has some of those Maillard reactions. They're really low, but you're going to get some kind of toasty little character to that. just a different flavor profile. So I think it can help round out the rye we're talking about and add additional flavors than if it's just 95% unmalted rye and a little bit of barley malt for enzyme. I think adding some rye malt can add complexity to your rye whiskey. And again, that we do have some large distilling customers that do add some or some that make particular runs. And we also see it used a lot more in craft distillers because, of course, they're trying to create flavors that might differentiate them from a large distillery's product, right? They want to create something that makes theirs unique and they want to make a different flavor profile so their customers really enjoy what they do. So those would be my two biggest hints that I would use or I would do personally if I was going to craft a rye whiskey is enzymes and the use of some rye malt and even specialty rye malts. You know, there's crystal rye and biscuit, heavily toasted rye, and there's even chocolate rye. And especially for craft distilling, all of that should be on the table. There's some really great stuff out there.
Chocolate rye. I don't know why that sounds delicious to me.
If you taste it in a spirit, there's definitely a roasty chocolate note to it, even on the white spirit as it comes off the stills. And it does really nicely in a barrel. It holds up. So you're seeing more chocolate malts and chocolate rye being used in craft distilling. Because again, it's something that truly sets yours to be unique.
That's so cool. Well, how about a little fun question? What are your favorite rye whiskeys to drink?
So, I lived in Salt Lake City for almost 30 years. I'm a huge fan of Rendezvous Rye from High West. I think they do some incredible things with rye, the double rye grade and some of the different blends that they do. So I'm a big fan of the High West Rendezvous Rye. For large commercial distilleries, Sazerac Rye is always a classic and especially great in cocktails, even thinking the traditional Sazerac cocktail. The Sazerac rye whiskey does really well in that. Bullet rye is another great. That's really a high rye, 95% rye. So that's a go-to and is usually sitting in my liquor cabinet somewhere.
Well, that's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Jeff. We're always very, very well. We're very, very lucky to have you as part of our team. And thank you for always coming on and teaching us all about the distilling world.
It's always my pleasure. I'm a very passionate world for me. So I love our craft distillers.
Well, can't wait to see you in a few weeks and we can maybe share a rye.
That sounds delicious. I'm on.
And now we are joined by Mac Remington. Mac is making his Brewdeck podcast debut. So welcome, Mac.
Thank you.
Mac is a production supervisor at Canada Malting. He's working in good old D House and he's making rye malts. So we wanted to bring Mac on to tell us all about the differences in working with rye versus working with barley. So Mac, can you just introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us what kind of got you into malting and how you ended up at Canada Malting?
Sure. I started in the brewing industry a good chunk of us in the malting industry. And I went to brewing school at UC Davis, developed my passion for malting and brewing in university, starting to homebrew, lived in Brazil for a year, got into homebrewing with some guys out there when I was finishing up my degree in supply chain, decided I wanted to take brewing on as a more of on a professional level. So I got my degree in brewing at UC Davis and then continued I got a gig with Molson Coors in Toronto and ended up working with a variety of their craft breweries throughout Canada from Creemore Springs to Granville Island in Vancouver, BC. I did that for about, I think it was five years of brewing and learning the business there. And then I got a great opportunity to go to what's actually our current competitor, Prairie Malt in Bigger, Saskatchewan. They're a similar size plant to what we have here in Calgary. They do about 200,000 tons a year. Not as many specialty products as we do in Calgary, but that's where I learned malting, primarily two row and Japanese export malt. And that was a Wunderhofen and a Flexi House plant. So there were two separate malt plants there. And that's where I learned from, I think that was 2019 to 2022. And then I took on a role here in Calgary. So I've been in Calgary for about 2.5 years. And I just took opportunities as they came about, and wanted to learn as many different malting systems as possible, and learn the business from the ground up. So I've been malting now for going on 5 years. So brewing for 5 years and malting for 5 years. And
that's a very storied career you have. That's very cool.
Yeah, I got to move around quite a bit. Molson was a great company, and knew that I was eager to take on further challenges and grow my knowledge on brewing. And then I just wanted to take the next step and learn malting, not because I knew everything in brewing, just because the opportunities aligned, and Vancouver, BC, to be honest, was getting kind of expensive.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I thought it might be a good idea to move to central Canada, move to Saskatchewan, just for a little bit calmer lifestyle and a little bit more laid back, and just take on an opportunity with a great malting company. And still have lots of good friends and contacts in Saskatchewan, and really learned a lot about grain harvesting, and learned a lot about the barley belt and just the culture that sort of surrounds barley growing in Canada. And, that was the prime region, and got some good exposure there. And then the town of 1500 got a little bit boring at times for me. And so it wasn't, I needed something kind of in the middle of where I was. From Vancouver to small town Saskatchewan was nice, but then it got just a little boring. So I ended up moving out to take on an opportunity with at the Calgary plant here with Canada Malting. So that's kind of the journey.
And awesome. Can you tell us where Saskatchewan is?
Montana,
just north of Montana.
Just north of Montana, yeah.
It's all beautiful barley growing region. So
yeah, I grew up right in Saskatchewan. I grew up in Moose Jaw,
which is cool. My favorite fact about Heather, because it's the most Canadian thing I've ever heard. Well, we are very lucky to have you at Canada Malting. So we want to jump right in. We're talking about rye today. Matt, can you tell us a little bit about the differences between malting rye versus malting barley?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk for hours about the differences, and to try to keep it short and simple will be a challenge. But we, about 5% of our malt production on site is malted rye. So we do about 3,000 to 4,000 tons of it a year. It fluctuates every year, but the demand seems to be growing. So we're really getting our process dialed in. But it is a more there's more effort involved in producing rye than typical two row base malt.
The sense that I get. We spoke to both a distilling expert and a brewer, and that's the sense that we got from speaking with them about using rye. There's a lot more effort that goes into it. And I'm sure it's the same, like you said, on the malting side.
Yeah, it's it's every year we basically, I wouldn't say the quality, but the parameters of our raw material do fluctuate a little bit, just like barley. But with rye, we really try to focus on bringing in as plump rye as possible. So if we can get 80-90% plump rye, that's going to make our job a lot easier. But some years your plumpness isn't as plump. You might only have 70 or 80% plump. And what happens then is that the kernels are even smaller than they typically are, and they tend to compact a lot easier. So starting in the steep tanks, we only do one immersion So once it's underwater, we steep in, it's underwater, and we set a target for around 37% moisture. So our operators are sampling, you know, as early as 7 or 8 hours into the first immersion. There's a lot of factors that affect the uptake of moisture into the kernel, and seasonalities are one of them. So in the wintertime, you might be able to hit your moisture targets in 10 or 11 hours. And in the summertime, you could maybe hit them at least a couple hours earlier than that. So it all depends on what your water reservoir temperatures are at. And that all stems from how warm or cold your well water is, which can change depending on the water table and the season. So you have to be very careful not to overshoot your moisture, as with any grain, but especially for rye, the consequences are can be devastating, because if your water's a little bit warmer than you'd like, maybe around that 11 or 12 degrees versus your 9 or 10 degrees, if your operators aren't efficient in grabbing those samples, your rye can pick up moisture too quick. And if you start getting into 40, 41, 42% moisture, your rye will become very soft. And it already is fairly soft because it doesn't have a husk. So what will happen is those smaller kernels and that softer outer shell will actually start to collapse and compact together. Even when it's underwater, there's compaction that's possible, and you'll never get it out of your tanks.
And sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, no problem.
Can you just do that in comparison to barley? Because I didn't know there was only one immersion for the steep when it comes to rye.
I've heard of others doing double immersion, like smaller double immersions, like two really, really small double immersions. Mm-hmm. But here at in D House, we run one single immersion. We do the same with wheat as well. And that could be just more due to the nature of our system. But it's what's been working for us. So we basically steep in, and once we hit our moisture, we drop all of our tanks. So we have 14 steep tanks. Each one holds about 16 to 20 tons to make a total of about 180 tons that we steep into our system. But the good part about having many smaller conical tanks is that the head pressure is a lot lower on the grains themselves versus having a few larger tanks or one really large tank that has all the grain in it at once. These smaller tanks are more optimal for specialty grains like rye and wheat because it's less hydrostatic pressure on the grains themselves. So long story short is that, we don't typically have that much issue dropping our tanks as long as we keep our moisture low enough. But we do drop everything all together. So we don't drain the first immersion and then drop the grain like any other barley malt. We drop everything together with all of the first immersion into the germ vessel by gravity.
That's crazy.
And the reason we do that is because we don't want to risk when you drain that first immersion. What'll happen is that all that rye will settle. And by the time it takes to drain that whole first immersion, you're getting a lot of extra compaction. Even in those small tanks, that you will get a lot of compaction. And if your moisture is just a little overshot, and it's not a perfect science, right? Because your sample is only your sample. So, you're only sampling a small portion of the tank. So you might think that you have 36 or 37% moisture, but you might actually have 40 or 42% in some parts of the tank, depending on how it's settled. And you might have some areas that are so compacted together that you might even have trouble physically knocking those chunks off the sidewalls of the tank. That's how sticky and difficult rye can be. So we try to get most of the grain down with the water to reduce the amount of effort it takes to empty the tanks. But usually it takes us about 45 minutes to drop regular barley down to our germ vessels. Rye can take up to 4 or 5 hours I would say quite regularly, it takes that long to get the tanks down. So it's like I say, it's a very manual, strenuous process to move this product anywhere. Just because of that exact reason, just compacts very easily.
When it comes to germination, what's the germ time on rye malt?
Yeah, so minimum 4 days. So we have a production schedule to maintain. So rye is not the only product that we produce. If we just produce rye, it might be a different case, but we produce other products like distillers, oats, wheat, red wheat. And we have to keep in mind that these other products are valuable as well. So we have to maintain a schedule. So it's 4 days germination for everything. Within that 4 days, you know, we can manipulate humidity, sprinkles, turning regimes, airflow and temperature to either speed up or slow down the modification process to cater to each type of product in the specialty house. So we can't just say, rye gets 3 days germination or rye gets 6 days germination and something else gets four. Everything gets 4 days germination because our system runs on a 24-hour cycle. So we have to load a kiln and unload a kiln every day, as well as we need to steep in a batch every day and drop a batch every day. So that's just the way that the system's set up. There's not much flexibility in terms of just cutting a day or two out of germination if we wanted to do that. So we're fixed to 4 days germination, but all the other variables we manipulate to optimize each specialty product and germination.
And so can you talk to us a little bit about kilning, the amount of time and the temperature that you're using for rye?
Yeah, rye. So rye retains moisture quite easily, and that is something that we need to keep in mind when we go to kiln. Because there's no husk, and that you do get some compaction and germination, you tend to retain a little bit extra moisture in the germ bed, which means that when you go to the kiln, you're carrying that to the kiln, which as part of the Maillard reaction, that's a fairly key component to creating color, whether intentional or not. So we usually use, we run our kiln fans as high as possible to limit stewing in the kiln, to limit color pickup. So color pickup's one of the biggest things in rye production that we have to watch, because it generates color very easily. And a lot of that has to do with the way that the grains settle in on each other in the kiln, mm-hmm. as well as germ, and it traps that moisture and almost, it's not steaming, but we call it stewing, where it's just that a little bit more of a stagnant or interrupted airflow. So your differential pressure below the bed and above the bed can be quite high, especially at the beginning of kilning. And that's where you have potential for stewing and color pickup. So we run high fans and lower temperature set points to try to mitigate that. And we've got our recipes fairly dialed in over the years. But I think on our last batches of rye, we didn't go much above 78 degrees Celsius on the cure. Whereas with our, you know, pale malts and, you know, export two row and all that, we go up to sometimes 87 or 88 degrees Celsius, 85 degrees Celsius on your cure.
So going back, you had mentioned the stewing. Is this something that you worry about? Is this just particular to rye, or is this something that you worry about with other barley types as well?
Any batch can be susceptible to it. It's just with the huskless varieties, your bed density is just so much higher that the airflow restriction is increased. So your risk of stewing is higher. So we try to get ahead of that and to mitigate it with higher airflow and lower temperatures.
to try to maximize that. We also have obviously a turning machine. It's kind of like a germ machine. It has helices, little screws that that allow airflow. So what we'll do is we'll run that on a regular sequence. So that kiln machine will actually run through on a set regime to allow airflow to move through the bed. So instead of just leaving the bed stagnant, we will run that machine through portions of the bed. If we notice that there's some slightly wetter sections or some sections that are a little bit more compacted, we'll run that machine through to allow more airflow to move through. To keep that also keeps your cycle times on track as well, and limits color pickup as well. So there's lots of little tricks we can do. Our system is from the 1950s, so we don't, you know, we're not a super modern specialty plant by any means. We have a lot of add-ons to our plant over the years, but really we're dealing with some older equipment and whatnot, and you know, we're just trying to make our plant work the best it can for us to deliver a good quality product. So we are limited to some degree in the age of our equipment, but we do make it work.
Awesome. And we appreciate you for doing so. So when we talk barley, we talk a lot about varietals, or varieties, excuse me. I'm a wine drinker, so I go varietals. Copeland, Metcalf, and so forth. Is there a specific rye variety that works best for malting?
So we don't explore too many different varieties of rye. The one that we've been using in the last couple of years has been the Rifle variety. It's a winter variety that we source from Southeast Alberta. And that's what I'm used to using. And that's what we've been getting. There's a lot of other rye that's grown in the province of Manitoba. But from my understanding, a lot of that rye goes into the food market, the baking market. And we don't source that because from what I understand, there's a lot more molds like fusarium and whatnot that can cause quality and performance issues in the malt house. So we stick with Southeast Alberta, where it's a little bit of a drier harvest season and better quality for us to malt. So that's what we're used to using here.
Oh, that's sweet. Well, yeah. I want to say thank you so much, Mac, for coming on and just sharing your rye malting expertise with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, that is a wrap on this ridiculously good episode of the Brew Deck podcast. Thank you to Spike, Mac, and Jeff for joining us today and sharing their expertise with us. A little thing we want to let you know, in case you missed it, the pallets that we have all been waiting for have finally landed in our warehouses, all of our warehouses. We are pleased to officially welcome Castle Malting to the CMG portfolio. It's bringing their highly regarded line of Chateau Malt products to the North America's brewers and distillers. So make sure to contact your sales rep to learn more and to try them out on your next brew.
That is something that the folks behind the scenes have been working on for a very long time. We've been very excited about it, and we finally get to talk about it. So super excited about that. A last bit of news before we wrap. The San Francisco World Spirits Competition was this past week. We're still waiting to hear the results, but we wanted to remind you about our Filson Vest Gold Medal Program, which awards a custom vest for each double gold in a whiskey category at the San Francisco World Spirits Competition, with at least 80% of the malt inclusion being Great Western Malting or Canada Malting co-ingredients. So very excited about that. It's a fun time of year to see all of those Filson vests come out.
It really is. And as we head to CBC, it is World Beer Cup time too. So stay tuned for more Filson vest gold medals that are going to be going out. Thanks everybody, and we will see you in Vegas.